The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 264.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey guys, I hope you are well. Welcome to this evening's live stream, public live stream Q&A here on Sunday night. I am at the Temporary Digs in Phoenix, Arizona. Actually, a very nice place, to be honest with you. I really enjoy the building. And right now in Phoenix, it's great. At least at night, it's fantastic. Perfect weather at night. So I like to do a lot of hiking. And when I go hiking, I'm having to do it in the evening, which is very pleasant. It helps you kind of clear your mind. Although the other night, we ran into a pretty good-sized rattlesnake. So as long as you're not running into rattlesnakes, it helps you clear your mind. And really, at least for me, it helps me distill some of the thoughts that I have. And actually, it helps me out in some of the whiteboard videos. Because when I'm up there hiking and out in the middle of nowhere and just by myself, sometimes you're able to take those complex ideas and kind of have some aha epiphany moments about them. But anyway, let's get into today's questions, guys. Thank you all for being here on the live stream. I am totally stoked. What do I want to pitch? What do I want to sell you guys right at the beginning here? I don't have much. Probably just the Rebel Capitalist Live. Let's go with that. January 7th through the 9th, Houston, Texas. We've got Ron Paul going to be in the house. We've got G. Edward Griffin going to be in the house. Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, my good buddy, the uneducated economist I just spoke with the other day, and many, many more of your favorite pros that I interview on the Rebel Capitalist Show. So if you want to get tickets at a discounted price, head over there as soon as the live stream is done at rebelcapitalistlive.com. All right, let's get into the questions. What do we got here? Okay, Wayne. George, did you see China released a white paper for the digital yuan? I believe I read some 25, maybe more million digital wallets have received. I didn't read the white paper, but it doesn't surprise me at all. In fact, this is part of the conversation that I had with my good buddy, the uneducated economist. But no, that doesn't surprise me. I think that's their game plan. And I think that I don't want to say if I was the Chinese, I'd be doing the same thing. I think that's a bit of a stretch. But if I was the Chinese and I wanted to compete with the United States and I wanted more control over my population, and if my biggest fear or concern as a Chinese central planner was social unrest, and I wanted access to commodities, and I wanted, I'm playing the long game, and I don't care anything about personal freedom and liberty, then I think it makes a lot of sense. And I totally understand why they're doing it. I get the whole Belt Road Initiative. I think that's part of the whole digital currency, central bank digital currency game plan. We have to remember here, when we're talking about the dollar or the digital dollar, the Fed coin, Bitcoin, the Chinese digital yuan, we're talking about a network. That we got to remember that. Most people think we're talking about money or currency units or something like that, or tokens of exchange, or a store value, or a medium of exchange, or whatever definition you want to have for it. We're not. We're talking about a network. Forget all those other definitions about money or currency or whatever. Think about a network is what you're dealing with. This is not the dollar competing against the digital yuan. This is Facebook competing with what would be a good example? I mean, Facebook has another network like that. I mean, it would be MySpace competing with Facebook, or Facebook competing with Apple. Maybe that's a better one. That's probably a much better one. Facebook competing with Apple. Or, yeah, I mean, because that's really Apple's kind of a network. It has that network effect because of the ecosystem it has with people having so much familiarity. I remember, you know, I'm an Apple person. Not that I agree with everything they do or say or anything like that, but as far as just the products themselves, I prefer Apple. And I remember one time I was actually living in Australia. This would have been maybe 2011, something like that. And I don't know what the heck happened. My phone broke or something like that. But I had to go and buy a new phone, and and I had to have one fast. And the only store around me, this was in Sydney, the only store around me, they didn't have any Apple phones. All they had were the Google phones, the Android. And I remember I bought one, and it was utterly unusable. It was the biggest piece of garbage. I couldn't even figure out like anything. I'm like, hell no. No, well, give me another, just get rid of this thing. Just get me an iPhone somehow. That's a network effect, right? And it's the same thing with Facebook. You guys know that. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But when you're dealing with the dollar, it's the exact same thing. It's Facebook. It's a network. And so when you're so then you have to ask yourself the question, what gives one network a competitive advantage over the other? Because currently in there, as they are right now, even Bitcoin, they have pros and cons. And I know the Bitcoin people don't like to hear me say that, but it is what it is. And by the way, if you tune into my channel just for confirmation bias, and just because you think I'm going to tell you what you want to hear, and just because you think I think the exact same things that you do, then you're tuning into the wrong dude. Unsubscribe right now. Because I'm not about confirmation bias. I'm not about making you feel good. I'm not about echo chambers. You know, I'm about critical thinking. And just, I'm here just to tell people what I think is true. I'm trying to poke holes in my own thinking, my own ideas, and take you guys along with me. And I'm trying to figure this out. And if I think I figure something out, then I try to explain it to you. If you're here for any other reason, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time. So anyway, and that goes for the Bitcoin guys, the gold guys, the commodities people, everybody, other than one group. And that's if you are a lover of personal freedom and liberty, then you're going to get all the confirmation bias you need and want from George Gammon. Or if you dislike politicians, that's the other group. But anyway, enough of the rant there. But no, seriously, Bitcoin, it's got, as it is in its current state, and I think even a lot of my good buddies like Nick Carter, Robert Breedlove, or kind of the more maximalist guys and gals would agree with that. But you've got to say, okay, well, so what would give one an advantage over the other? And one thing that most people forget, they look at all of these other things and they get into the nuance and the idiosyncrasies of this tech and that tech and this tech, and they just forget about lending. They forget about lending. And then not only do they forget about lending, but they forget about interest rates. You see, why is it that Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake theory, you guys know that well. Why is it that there is so much dollar denominated debt outside of the United States with sovereigns and corporates? Because back in 2011, 2012, or during that time frame, the dollars were really, 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 really cheap to borrow. So if I've got to be a part of the euro system or the yen system, well, I guess the yen were even cheaper. But you know, if I've got to be a part of the euro system, actually, maybe the euros were cheaper to borrow as well. Well, so those are bad examples, aren't they? If I've got to be a part of my own system or my own network, let's say you're a Colombian corporate and you have to pay a 12% interest rate, are you going to take that or are you going to take the dollar at 4% interest? Right. And so then what the, and I don't want to go off on a complete tangent, but then the question becomes, that's right. Because you'd have to have dollars. The whole reasons, one of the main reasons you would borrow the dollars, I was thinking what would be the difference between the yen and the euro if you could get the yen at a cheaper interest rate. But if you borrow the yen, then you're not going to be able to buy the stuff you need to run your business because 60 or 70% of the transactions in the globe are done in dollars. Therefore, you need the dollars in the first place, not just to service the debt, but to run your business. You see, so that's, and that goes into the network effect here. George, what's your point? It's that the Belt and Road Initiative and the Chinese creating a digital yuan is a network. And the advantage of that central bank digital currency is they don't need to lend based on profit and loss. They can lend to whomever and they can undercut the competition as far as interest rates. If there was a corporate, now again, the corporation would have the problem, I can't buy the stuff I need because I'm getting yuan and people will take dollars. Aha, but there you got the Belt Road Initiative. So all of these entities and groups can do business with one another and they don't need dollars to do it. See, that's kind of where the magic happens. And then if we do not have a Fed coin, or in other words, if we don't have a dollar central bank digital currency, a U.S. Digital currency, then where are you going to get the cheapest interest rate? From the Bank of China that really doesn't need to be paid back, or from a commercial bank in or outside of the United States that definitely needs to be paid back? Not only paid back with interest, but they also need to be paid back relative to the rate of inflation and the risk premium. You see what I'm saying? So if you could use yuan to buy all the things that you need and to do business, and it's just a matter of where you're going to get the cheapest loan, I can almost guarantee you, you're going to be able to get a cheaper loan from a central bank. Then you're going to be able to get a loan even in the same currency from a commercial bank because one is constrained by a P&L and the other is not. Where am I parking the cash from the recent sale of my rent? I can't. It's very frustrating. They're not sold yet because they're not rehabbed yet and because I just haven't had the time to manage it. And my real estate agent is fantastic. She's amazing. But she's got all these, things that she's trying to do. And we can't get any good help in there to actually do the remodels. So they're just sitting there doing nothing. I'm just getting lucky right now because they are doing something. They're appreciating significantly in value. But if it were up to me, I would have sold them 6 months ago. It's just they're not rehabbed yet because we can't get anyone in there to do the rehab. So that's why when you asked that question, I wasn't frustrated with your question. I'm frustrated that we haven't gotten these darn rental properties up to the point where we can sell them for top dollar yet. And what's going to end up happening is I'm probably going to have to just fly out to Kansas City and just make it happen myself when I get some time, or at least get the ball rolling and get the people in there and then have my real estate agent take it from there. And I want to be clear, it's not her fault because she's amazing. She's the best real estate agent you could possibly have. Her name is Christina Brown. And if you're thinking about doing anything in Kansas City, she is the only person to use. Christina Brown is her name. Okay. I guess I could answer where would I park the cash. If where would I park the cash? Initially, it would be in T-bills, just until I figured out a better place to do it. And then I'd just look around for what's cheap. I would probably see another part of this question, Clark, is what does the world look like when these things sell? Right? In other words, can I get to Dubai? I mean, let's say I get an extra $2 million, okay, that I would like to continue to pay me to own it, you know, income with, I'd like to keep it in real estate, something that's, and hopefully not to have too much of a risk against the dollar. You know, Dubai is at the top of my list, but I have to go there and kick tires, and I am not going to go anywhere to do anything if I have to wear a mask in a gym or in a grocery store. I'm just not going to do it. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. If you want to wear a mask in a grocery store, gym, go nuts. I think you should have the right to do it. And I don't think you're ridiculous. I don't think you're, you know, I don't just immediately assume you watch CNN. I don't care. I don't care what you want to wear 18 masks. You want to wear a hazmat suit in a grocery store. I don't care at all because it doesn't affect me. I don't care. Just do what you want to do. Live life, live and let live. Right. But just for me personally, I don't want to do that. And so, assuming that things are back to normal in Dubai, when if I were to get an extra, let's say, couple million dollars that I wanted to put into real estate, right at the top of my list would be Dubai. But I'd have to go there and kick tires first. And I could come in a week later, I could come to the conclusion that I want nothing to do with Dubai. I can change my mind, especially with real estate. I can change my mind just faster, so fast it'll make your head spin, like my father used to say. So, but that would kind of be the initial kind of game plan. And then if I couldn't find anything there, and I would need to parlay it into something other than real estate, then it would just be, you know, I try to find some cheap dividend paying stocks, because that money right now, or has been paying me to own it, or that equity has been paying me to own it for a long, long time. And so I want it to continue to pay me to own it. And I've already got too much in Colombia, as far as a percentage of my portfolio. So I got to find other options. Turkey might be a good option too. But same thing. I'd want to go there and kick tires and whatnot.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
If the Fed was abolished, what would stop another entity like China from simply printing money and buying up property? Well, why would the Fed need to be abolished for that to happen? I don't know why the Fed would need to be abolished. All the central bank would have to do, look at Switzerland. What are they doing to keep their currency from appreciating too much against the euro. And hopefully this was Switzerland. And I'm going right off the top of my head here, guys. So I'm almost positive it was Switzerland. So what did they do to keep the Swiss franc from... now I'm curious here. Let me see. Yeah, 99% sure it was Switzerland. But what did they do to prevent their currency from appreciating too much in value against the euro? They printed more of their currency. And what did they do with it? They bought shares in Apple. So in retrospect, good move. Right? But you get my point, think and grow rich. There's nothing that would prevent the Swiss or the Chinese from doing that, regardless of whether the Fed is involved or not. Now, what would prevent them from doing that is their currency. So if, you know, and they're playing with fire too, in my opinion, because then what if those assets go down in value? I mean, that's not a game I would want to play. Especially if I was managing or trying to manage the currency of an entire country, for heaven's sakes, which is why we should have free banking and it should be completely decentralized. Whether you're using gold as base money or Bitcoin as base money, or I don't care what you're using as base money, we should have free banking. And that's where the banks themselves are issuing their own currency. Then we don't have to worry about this nonsense. The release valve there is the currency. So, I mean, in a way, that's exactly what the Japanese did back in the 1980s, especially the late 80s, when you had the, I believe it was called the Ministry of Finance, which was, basically put a gun to the heads of the bankers and said, lend. You know, they didn't threaten them with violence, but maybe they did in some cases. But from what I gather from Richard Werner's work on the subject, they basically told the bankers, you lend or you lose your job. Period. Lend a lot. And once you lend a lot, lend more. And as a result, you know, if you guys were, if you're around my age or older, I'm sure you remember back in the late 80s, what was happening and what was the vibe in the United States. The Japanese are taking over the world. I remember that. I remember that very, very well. Hearing that on the news almost every single day. The Japanese are taking over the world. The Japanese bought Pebble Beach. The Japanese bought this. The Japanese bought that. They bought this. They're buying up everything in the United States. And that was a big deal. Like that was a real concern for the average American back then. Very similar to how inflation was like the hot topic, the concern in the 1970s. That was the big concern and the hot topic in the United States in the late 80s, that the Japanese are going to own the whole country. So, you know, how did that happen? Well, through basically lending and them having all this additional yen that hadn't depreciated in value yet, and their system was able to sustain it temporarily, right? At the end of the day, there's no free lunch. You can't just currency or even money in and of itself is not purchasing power. It's not. The only thing that's purchasing power is productivity. That's it. So if you have a period of time, whether you're an individual, a corporation, or a country, where your level of consumption exceeds the rate of your productivity, at some point in time, you're going to have to pay the fiddler. I mean, that takes, I'm sure I'm going to go off on another tangent here, but it takes me back to the hyperinflation in Germany. When did the German hyperinflation start? When were the seeds of Weimar Germany? When were they sown? Remember that almost the entire move in the hyperinflation or the significant portion of it, was just in almost just 1 year. 1923. So when were the seeds of the hyperinflation sown? And let me add to that a statistic that nobody talks about. Nobody talks about is that the 2 years preceding, or year and a half or so, preceding the massive hyperinflation of 1923, the German currency actually appreciated in value against the dollar and therefore against gold. Marks that were denominated in gold, it appreciated in value. The fiat went up in value relative to those things. And a year later, it was toilet paper. See? Another statistic that most people don't know, and I may have the number slightly off here, but in 1922, let's say at the beginning, this is prior to the hyperinflation. They had inflation, significant inflation prior to that, but it wasn't this hockey stick parabolic hyperinflation that they saw in 1923. So just prior to that, there were roughly 180 billion German marks in the entire world. In the entire world. On planet Earth, inside and outside of Germany, 180 billion. 1 year later, 12 months later, it cost you 180 billion marks to buy a newspaper. That, my friends, is hyperinflation. The equivalent would be looking at our current M2 money supply, roughly, because that's not really the amount of dollars in the system. But let's just assume for a moment it is. Right around 20 trillion. So that would be like 12 months from today. Today. So July 18th, 2022, a newspaper in the United States would cost you $20 trillion. That's why they say when the inflation genie gets out of the bottle, it's real tough to get her back in. But my point is, when were the seeds of that hyperinflation sown? During 1920, 21? You would think so, because the mark was appreciating in value relative to the dollar, as an example. But you would be wrong. See, the seeds of the hyperinflation were sown starting in 1914, when they started printing money to pay for World War I. And their M2 money supply started to go up by 65% per annum. And you say, oh, well, George, give me some context there. That doesn't mean anything to me. It sounds like a big number, but I'd like to remind you, to give you some context that would apply to us today, that the M2 money supply in the United States in 2020 went up by 25%. Granted, it's not 65%, but we have now, the central planners have now put our economy into a position to where it is addicted to government deficit spending, and that spending being monetized by the Fed. In other words, it's addicted to M2 money supply going parabolic. And if we don't have M2 money supply going parabolic, which, by the way, is now on the shoulders of the government and the commercial banking system. Usually, it's just the commercial banking system, which adds a whole nother level of complexity to the situation. But unless we continue to have the amount of dollars in the system, at least measured as by M2, going up and up and up and up and up and up, then our economy is going to go crash, 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 because that's what's most likely going to happen to the stock market. Massive asset deflation, right? So my point is, yes, 2020 might have been 25%, but in my opinion, the probabilities are high that in the future, it might not be 2021, but in 2022, 2023, it's not, it's going to have to go up. You know, it was 25% in 2020. Oh, the next year or 2 years later, it might have to be 30. The next year, it might have to be 50. It might have to be 60. It might have to be 70. It might have to be 80. It'll have to go up to 100. It'll be just like quantitative easing, where you start with whatever QE1 was. I believe it was maybe, what was it, 50, 60 billion a month, roughly? And that was just outrageous back then. And remember, Ben Bernanke told us, oh, don't worry about it. Just a temporary measure. Nothing to see here. Nothing to see here. Oh, this is just a temporary extreme measure for extreme times. And as soon as we do it just a couple times here, we'll just reel it right back in and we're good to go. Wrong. Once you started QE, you not only had to keep QE, but you had to do bigger QE and bigger QE and bigger QE and bigger QE. Today, not only did we not do quantitative tightening, not only is the Fed's balance sheet not back down to $800 billion, it's, oh, by the way, over $8 trillion, but we're doing $120 billion worth of QE. It's going to be the same thing, in my opinion, with the supply of dollars. Now, that's not to say that the dollar can't appreciate in value against other fiat currencies, to throw you a curveball. For all of you dollar bears out there and inflationistas who wanted confirmation bias, let me throw some cold water on you. It doesn't necessarily mean the dollar is going to go down against other fiat currencies. In the long run, I think it will. In the long run. That's 10, 15 years, something like that, because there's got to be that release valve. There has to be. But in a year, who knows? Again, the German mark, 1 year prior to it being toilet paper, was literally appreciating in value against other fiat currencies. It would be like, you guys know the DXY, right? That's the dollar against a basket of other currencies. Just pretend we're talking about 19, 20, 21. That would be like the German mark going from 90 on the DXY over that 2 year span or a year and a half, going all the way up to 100. And then in a year's time, going from 100 down to zero. That's what happened. So you see, my point is that in the short run, who knows? The dollar could go to 130, 140. I don't know. But what I do know is the underlying fundamentals are wildly dollar bearish over the long run. Over the long run. And especially when you're comparing the dollar to goods and services. That's the key, because what it does against other fiat currencies, even in the, although the long run, I think, is much more easy to predict than the short term. But the key there, and what we really care about, is what is the dollar doing against goods and services? And so there, I think, I struggle with seeing the dollar appreciate in value against the majority of goods and services. It might appreciate in value a little bit against used cars. But again, see, I don't think there's a deflation there. I think that there's just going to be disinflation. And I think the probability is that you see disinflation. I agree with Lynn Alden. And then it's like the 1940s. You see these spikes of inflation where 1 year you get like a 10% up, bam, even as measured by the CPI. And then the next year you don't get deflation, but the rate of inflation goes down, let's say to 6% or something, you know, as measured by the CPI. So you have kind of a disinflation thing. That doesn't mean that we are in deflation to where consumer prices are going down by 10%. In my opinion, that would be, anything is possible, but it would, the probabilities are incredibly low. And then it gets even more nuanced when we're talking about asset prices. When I'm on in my videos, when I'm talking about potential deflationary tailwinds, usually I'm not talking about consumer prices. I'm usually talking about asset prices and having a deflationary deleveraging when it comes to debt, or an inflationary deleveraging when it comes to debt. And if it's talking about debt, it's going to be talking about asset prices. I should, probably shouldn't have gone off on that tangent there, but it is what it is. I guess I'm just in a tangent type of mood today. What is a good amount of fiat for having living expenses before investing 3-6 months? This is probably the only thing I agree with Dave Ramsey on, and you know, probably 6 months, I think, something like this. But the main thing I would be trying to do is I would be working my tail off as much as I needed to get enough assets that pay me to own them that are paying my monthly expenses, so I don't have to worry about saving. Because let's say your monthly expenses are $4,000 a month, right? Although this is smart, you do want like kind of an emergency fund here. But the very next step for me personally would be trying to figure out a way that I can control enough assets, maybe with other people's money, i.e. real estate, right? To where you've got enough positive cash flow coming in or maybe a side hustle, something like that, where your $4,000 expenses are being paid by the assets you own. That's why I'm so adamant about having, you know, a large portion of your portfolio that pays you to own it. That's how I define an investment, because that's the only way that you'll truly be financially free. You know, Dave Ramsey says that you're financially free after you don't have any debt. Well, not really. Not really. That's still not going to put food on the table, right? In my opinion, you are quote unquote financially free, or as free as you possibly can be. You know, there's no ultimate freedom, but you're as free as you possibly can be when your assets are paying all of your monthly personal expenses. So whether your monthly net for your family is $4,000, whether it's $10,000, whether it's $20,000, whether it's $2,000, whatever it is, the bottom line is when you own assets that are paying those expenses for you and most likely will pay them for you for the rest of your life, or have a good, there's a high probability that they will pay those expenses for you for the long run. Like having a great, awesome, amazing rental property in an A neighborhood, then you are financially free. And then you don't have to worry about saving money as much. Now you still want to save money. You still want to grow your investments, but you're not going to lose sleep over it. Because you've got your 6 month emergency fund, and you know that even if you know something happened, or even if you decided that you didn't want to work anymore, you wouldn't have to. It's freedom, and then you know your wife would be taken care of, or your husband, or your kids, or whatever. That would be my objective. Someone had a question about price controls. I do think we'll see price controls. And I would highly recommend the last podcast episode that my good buddy Eric Townsend did with Russell Napier. And Eric's podcast is called Macro Voices. I'm sure most of you listen to it. And if you don't listen to it, you should. But go back and listen to Russell Napier's view on how the government will try to manage inflation. And I think that's probably the highest. That's my base case, as Lynn would say. So that means that the central planners take more control over the lending. And I don't know if Russell kind of went as far as I go. I don't think he really talked about that being a central bank digital currency. I think he talked about the government just kind of controlling bank lending more than they already do. I think he kind of left it at that. Where you guys know my opinion, I think the Fed will try to take complete control over, or at least backstop it, to where there are no constraints on lending anymore based on profit and loss and credit worthiness. That's really the bottom line. But then he says they'll do that, and in addition to that, they'll most likely use price controls, and they'll do that because they want to do universal basic income. And they know that universal basic income, if monetized by the Fed, will create additional dollars. So they just create the additional dollars by just giving it out to whomever they want to give it to. And then they control the price inflation through price controls like we saw in the 1970s and by managing the amount of bank credit in the system. In other words, the additional dollars being created by the commercial banks through additional lending.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What would happen to the current U.S. market if Biden had a stroke or was removed? Listen, Stephen, I'm not someone that believes the president matters that much. You know, like Trump likes to take, every president likes to say that under my presidency, this was done, as though they had anything to do with it. You know, give me a freaking break. I mean, come on. Right. Or, you know, we've got this jobs program. The politicians like to say we're going to use infrastructure to create jobs. What are you talking about? Biden's not creating a job. Trump isn't creating a job. We are creating the jobs. The rebel capitalists, the entrepreneurs, the producers, the people that are out there willing to take risk with their personal savings and work 80 hours a week and sacrifice things that no other people are willing to sacrifice and take risks that no other people are willing to take. We are the ones that create the jobs. Trump doesn't create a job. Now, he did what as an entrepreneur, but I'm saying not as a president, right? Biden, what? Tell me, show me the job that Biden has created in his life. Show me the job that AOC has created. Show me the job that Elizabeth Warren has created. And I know I'm picking on the left, but pick on the guys on the right. Show me the job that Mitch McConnell. And I don't know his background. Maybe he was an entrepreneur. So if he was, then I apologize to Mitch. But assuming he was a lifetime politician, you show me the job that they created. They didn't create any jobs. The only job they created is just choosing who they want to be their personal assistant. Or maybe I should say it this way. Show me the government job they didn't create. Or show me the job outside of government they created. Zero. Goose egg. They don't know what it's like. Let me tell you. If the politicians were honest, which obviously they're not, but just assuming they were, like, and I've said this about Richard Wolff, who's the Marxist teacher. He likes to call himself a communist, but that's just because he likes to really rile people up and stuff. If you watch my interview with him at the end, he admits, he's like, I'm not technically a communist, but I think he would consider himself a Marxist, right? Even if, you know, I thought through what would be the best way to get my point about free market capitalism through to someone like Dr. Wolf, or assuming these politicians outside of Trump, who's created jobs in the real economy, assuming these politicians were honest, which they're not, how would I get my message across to AOC or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, assuming they had an open mind and they were intellectually curious, right? Very, very simple. You'd only have to do one thing. And I know this from experience. All you would have to do is make them a manager of a call center for maybe 2 or 3 months. And I promise you, at the end of that 3 months, they would no longer be a socialist. They would understand how important entrepreneurs were. They would understand the value the entrepreneur provides to the production of goods and services. You see, because the socialists, they believe that the entrepreneur or the boss or whatever, or the capitalist is just, they're just a waste. All they are is just, they're just there to skim the profits off the top. They don't matter. The only thing that matters are the employees. The employees could run the whole business, or in this case, the employees could run the whole call center by themselves. They don't need the boss. They're the ones answering the phones anyway. The boss isn't there answering the phones. So let's just eliminate the boss. Let's eliminate the entrepreneur. Let's eliminate the capitalist. We don't need them. Okay. If that's your opinion, like I said, just go out there and try to manage a call center for 3 months where you're dealing with, at the time I had a 40 seat call center. This was back in 2007, 2008. And it wasn't my main business. It was just a part of my business. Right. But try managing 40 or 50 or 100 telemarketers that are $10 an hour employees. Or maybe now $15 an hour employees. Just try that out for 3 months. And you let me know how well the employees would manage that call center without the entrepreneur and without the capitalist. So you see my point, Stephen. Is the president, we like to think the president matters a lot more than they actually do. I always say the best thing a president can do, it's like, well, I was going to go off and say a quote from someone, but you guys won't know who he is anyway. But I always said the best president on the planet Earth, in my opinion, would be the president that as soon as they are elected, they take a vacation for the next 4 years. Just go play golf. I don't care who you are, Obama, Trump, Biden, just don't do anything. Just do nothing. Just shut up. Don't do any, no more laws. Don't, nothing. If anything, reduce the laws, reduce the regulations, but just get out of the way. Get out of the way. Go lock yourself in a cave. And if you're Biden, just go lock yourself in a cage and wear 15 masks. And just shut up. Just do nothing. Just take a vacation for 4 years. And I'm obviously that would be Biden's ideal of fun. I mean, what would be more fun than locking yourself in a cage and wearing 15 masks and being a hypochondriac? I mean, that's his idea of a vacation, obviously. And then he could just get his stimmy checks. and he wouldn't even have to go out to the mailbox. But you see my point. The only thing the presidents can do is get in the way. The only thing the politicians can do is get in the way. Here's how you have strong economic growth. Because the people that have a contrary belief system, well, oh, George, you stupid free market guys, you Austrians, oh, you just think that the free market is the solution for everything and we don't need law. Go to Somalia and see how well your libertarian ideals work there, you know, which is literally the most retarded thing that anyone could possibly say. But the point is not that we don't have rule of law. That's not the same as not having politicians. You see, in order for an economy to grow in a healthy manner, to have a structurally sound economy, you need the following. You need rule of law. You need a sound currency. You need low taxes and a way to adjudicate a legal system, basically, and very low, if you want to throw in there, obviously that would be very small government, very low business regulations. If you look at the countries on Earth, they're becoming fewer and fewer and fewer, but look at the countries that have rule of law, have a sound currency, and have low taxes, and are very pro-business, have very low a very low regulatory environment. Look at every one of those countries. Are they the poorest countries on the planet Earth? No, they're the richest countries on Earth. Even countries with no resources. Look at Singapore. They don't have any resources at all. None. Zero, for heaven's sakes. Even Japan doesn't have that many natural resources, right? So that's what you need. Well, let me say it again so we're all on the same page here. Sound currency. You need rule of law. You need hopefully low taxes and low regulatory environment for business. You got those four things, and you're going to be jamming. The president of the United States or the president of that country doesn't matter. They'd be better off just going to the golf course for the next 4 years. Or again, in Biden's case, his idea of a vacation is just locking himself in a cage, wearing 15 masks, and receiving his stimmy check, and just communicating with other human beings on Zoom for the rest of his life. Look at Sweden. Exactly, look at Sweden. I'd say exactly. Because your point here is if you're trying to contradict what I'm saying, like, oh, no. Look at Sweden. It's rich. They have high taxes. No, look at their corporate rate. Look at Sweden's corporate rate. It's actually relatively low. So what do entrepreneurs in Sweden do? They just get around the tax system by keeping all their money in the corporation. And they let the corporation pay all their expenses. I mean, Sweden proves what I'm saying. But it's just Sweden, they look at it and say, oh, it's this high tech. Yes, it's a welfare state. I get it. They have big government. I get it. But they have components of what I was talking about, and the low taxes, they do have that with their corporate taxes, and which all entrepreneurs have to do is just leave the money in the corporation and have the corporation pay all their bills. Now that may be legal or not. I don't know the tax laws in Sweden, but I can almost assure you that that's what most of them are doing, in one way or the other. And that's not to say that Sweden wouldn't be even better if it adopted the policies of, let's say, an old school Hong Kong or Singapore. Have you heard of the new digital fiat dollar will be based on XRLP. I don't know. These Elias, this is a great question, buddy. But I just, in all honesty, I get so frustrated with how can I articulate this? The problem we have right now, one of the big problems we have in the West, and especially in the United States, is our economy is way over financialized. Way, way, way over financialized. Remember the example the picture I like to paint is that the idea of the hot air balloon. You guys have all seen those big hot air balloons. You go up there, you know, they're flying up on Saturday or Sunday mornings or whatever. And at the bottom of that hot air balloon is the basket. Right? A healthy economy is where the real economy, the production of goods and services, is the balloon. That's what's guiding the basket. The basket's just following wherever the balloon goes. An unstable economy, which is what we have right now in the United States, is where the roles are reversed, where the hot air balloon is the financial economy and the basket is the real economy. And whenever I hear people, whether it's in the crypto space, whatever crypto it is, saying that, oh, this is going to allow us to you know, do this with finance, this with finance, this with financial institutions can do this and 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 this. I'm like, that doesn't solve the problem. All you're doing is just creating a more efficient bad system that we already have. And then the argument is, well, no, this will create more goods and services. Really? Really? You think if Jamie Dimon and the banksters somehow had a more efficient way to create derivatives through cryptocurrencies or whatever you're talking about, any new technology really, that somehow makes the problem better? I don't think so. And then the Bitcoiners say, oh, well, this solves the problem, George, because of course Bitcoin solves the problem to everything. This solves the problem because it just decentralizes all the money. So JP Morgan or Jamie Dimon wouldn't have any control over it. And therefore, the entire financial system would be decentralized. Okay. Well, if it's decentralized, you still have the same problems. And what's the core problem? The core problem is that we're imperfect human beings. The problem is that we live in an imperfect world. Therefore, whatever money you have is going to behave imperfectly, no matter how genius it is. It's just a matter of time. It's cyclical, right? So now that Bitcoin network and that decentralized process may be superior for several reasons. But I think it brings us right back, whether it's 20, 30, 40 years down the road, to the same place we are right now, where everything is over-financialized. Because when you financialize the system, what that allows you to do is consume more than you produce. And that is a very, very addictive drug to imperfect human beings. Like us, like me, like everyone on this live stream. All right, guys, I got to head over to my member live stream. So we're going to have to save the shout outs for next week. I had over 1,000 people on today. Thank you for joining me, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.